legal system that we're obligated on every single detail, and why do we work out every single detail? Okay? There are two reasons. Okay? One reason is we have a legal system, and the legal system, if we keep the legal system, then we will be able to train our minds to think correctly in every single area. That's one of the reasons. This is what the Rambam says, that one of the reasons for the benefit of living the life of Torah, it forces you to get involved in the ideas, what is kosher, what is not kosher, what is permissible, what is not permissible, what is obligatory, what is not obligatory. You say, all these things, when you get involved in all these ideas and every detail, it forces you to think clear about the ideas and to make more distinctions. So it's a training of the mind. Okay? The second reason is sometimes there are certain emotions that we have that are very hard to control. Right? So what God did is He made laws in the area where it's difficult to control to help us control it. I'll give you an example. There are two ways of going on a diet. There's one, a diet, I have certain rules, I'm allowed to eat a certain amount of calories, and that's it for the day. So I have to count my calories, and I divide the calories over the day, over three meals or five meals, but I have to live a certain type of life. There's another way of going on a diet. To distinguish between when I'm eating for emotional reasons and when I'm eating for hunger. For hunger, I should eat enough to remove hunger, but I should never eat for emotional reasons. That is a very, very difficult thing to do. Most people, if they went on such a diet, especially if you have addiction to food, you're going to make terrible mistakes. You're just not going to be able to control yourself. So to be able to control yourself, you make rules of how to live. That's exactly what God did for certain emotions that we have. God made certain rules to help us to protect those emotions from going wild. So therefore, some of the laws in general were created to training of the mind, but there are certain particular laws that were made for the prevention of allowing an outlet for certain emotions which would be contrary to God.
This is chapter 12, verse 3, and it says, a man will not be firm in his wickedness, and the root of the righteous will not falter. In other words, the wicked in their lifestyle, there's no firmness or security in their lifestyle. While the righteous, their shorishes, their roots, cannot falter, cannot change. What is the difference between the wicked and the righteous insofar as these qualities are concerned? The first possibility is that because the wicked act on impulse, so therefore they will fail. And the tzaddik that thinks everything out, therefore he will not fail. The only problem with that is that there are certain types of wicked people that plan everything. Yeah. And here it's making a general statement about all wicked people, whether they plan things out, whether they have strategy or not. There's no real security. The question is, why is there no security for the wicked? The answer is that the wicked, their security is in the physical world. In other words, power, money, fame, whatever it might be, their security. Okay? While the righteous, their security is all within. It's not based outside in the physical world, but it's based all in their mind. So their security is from within. while the security of the wicked are from without, and that security is not a 100% secure. This is Proverbs chapter 12, verse 4. Okay? And it says, a woman of valor is a crown to her husband, and like rot in his bones is an evil woman. Okay? And now I'd like to clarify some of the words. The word bala, husband, comes from the word bal, an owner, that he owns her, and therefore when she's an Eishes Chayil, so then it gives him a crown. But however, the word for evil is mevisha. Mevisha means an embarrassment, and so it's an embarrassment to him, a woman that's a bad woman. So, and it's like rotten his bones. When it's rotten your bones, there's no hope. Okay? The first question is, what do we mean by bad? That's true. Okay, that's the first question. And also, the word valor, okay? The word valor, according to the dictionary, is courage and fearlessness. Okay? Valor. The word valor is courage and fearlessness. Okay? So it says a fearless woman, or a woman of courage, is a crown to a husband, and like rotten his bones is a woman that will embarrass him. In other words, that does something wrong that will embarrass him. In other words, the woman of valor is defined by what she does for her husband. Now, the thing is, I'd like... Now, we see there are different relationships that in the Torah that a woman has to a husband. Like, for instance, by Abraham, she told Abraham that you have to throw your son Yishmael out. She had equality, even though she was a woman of the tent, as sages say, that she stayed inside a tent and she did all the work, the cooking and all these things. But the thing is that she related to her husband in an equal way. We find by Yitzchak, on the other hand, Yitzchak, she didn't tell him anything, and she faked him out Isaac wanted to give the blessing to Esau, so she didn't come and speak to him, but she faked him out. That was a different type of relationship, and that was an Eishes Chayil in the sense that she was protecting her husband from giving the wrong blessing. Okay, the right blessing to the wrong person. And you also find by Devorah, they say Devorah was married to Barak. Barak was the general that went out to war, and he wanted her to come along, so she went along with him. So she was the Eishes Chayil because she did that was necessary for her husband. So in other words, whatever is necessary to glorify the husband, so therefore the woman has that responsibility and to help her husband in his to get his crown. Now the question is, if this is true, it sounds like the woman should be subservient to the man. And the question is, then why does it use the word a woman of valor, or a woman of fearlessness, or a woman of courage? I mean, if you're just subservient to somebody, that doesn't take courage. That's a weakness, if you're subservient to somebody. And yet here the Torah is calling her a woman of valor. Somebody wants to say maybe there's just two different jobs, the two different areas in a family, then each one has their own responsibility. That would be true, but however, the verse says that the verse puts her in relationship only, she is worth only in relationship to the husband, and to her is his glory, or how she embarrasses him, you see. So the thing is, that sounds like subservient. And yet the Pasuk calls it a woman of valor. Question is, what's different? In other words, the one part of the Pasuk defines her in terms of a husband, and yet we call that valor. You see what I mean? So, I mean, you might give me examples of where women have good things or good qualities, but the verse is defining her in terms of a husband, and that has to be explained. In other words, you can give me different examples how, like Sarah just told her husband, you know, to throw him out. That's true. But the thing is, you see that she lived in the tent and all these things, so it was all for his benefit, you see? But, and the Torah puts her in the role of only insofar as his benefit is concerned. It sounds like subservient, not fearlessness. Not fearlessness. In other words, her whole existence, the way the verse is written, is for him. And yet we call that fearlessness and courage. Doesn't sound that it works out. In other words, subservience is a certain type of weakness. In other words, Doug has wanted to say that there's a team effort working here. And there's certain people that help the other, like in a... when the race car driver, so in the pit, there are people that work on the car. Now, there's no fearlessness in that. They have a job to fix the car as fast as possible to make him look good. In football, I understand where somebody is... in football, I understand that you can get hurt. But to help somebody else either run with the ball or throw the ball. But the thing is that in general, team effort is usually that you work for somebody else. And I'll show the proof, because most people are, even though they have the team effort, but they are jealous of the person that stands out. And they're upset about that. Why shouldn't I get any credit for it? I'd like to define courage, okay? Courage or fearlessness means, according to the whole view of Mishlei, of Proverbs, is that when a person sees something is totally correct and he lives by that idea, that is courage and fearlessness. When you live by that idea, despite that your emotions might be against it, but you live by a true idea. Now, I want to say that when King Solomon wrote about the Eishes Chayil, the woman of valor, and he writes a whole chapter on it, the last chapter in the book of Proverbs, he writes about the whole chapter about the lifestyle of the woman of valor. What he is describing is the end result of a person that lives the life of Mishlei or Proverbs. In other words, that a person is guided totally by their mind what is right. And what is right is sometimes to do something for somebody else where there is no benefit to you, only because it's just or kind to do it, and therefore you do it. You see? Even though, despite the fact that you might feel there's an emotion that, why should he be in the head? Why shouldn't I be on top? That emotion does not stop them from living the correct thing. But I think what King Solomon did is that there is a system of justice, and he describes the system of justice in a very small, compact family situation. There is a system of justice, and everybody in that family, in that group, has a certain responsibility. And they're saying that in other words, there's no difference if you go outside and let's say you would go do justice in the world. I mean, Devorah was a wife, and yet she went out and she was a judge and she judged people and went out in public and did things. She was a person that was doing for the community. It doesn't matter, man or woman, when you do for somebody else, there's a
feeling that the emotions make you feel that there's that why should I be doing for them, or what am I getting out of it? I must be getting something out of it. The Eish HaChayil has reached a level. The Eish HaChayil, the woman of Baal, has reached a level where they recognize that the only life to live is the life of truth, justice, and kindness. And therefore, they, when they're subservient, is because they live that life. And that is the courage. The courage and fearlessness is to live by the world of ideas, even though you're totally against your emotions. I think that's also another one of the reasons why in Torah we have the idea of justice. And even to Jews and non-Jews all over, we have an obligation of justice. And the idea of justice is because to take away from the ego, and it gives us a certain recognition that I'm part of a group, and I must make sure the group is successful. Even if I don't get any reward for it, even if nobody knows that I'm doing it for them, I must do it because I do it because of the truth. And I believe the Eish HaChayil, the nature of the Eish HaChayil, is a result of the whole book of Mishlei. The question is, in other words, the motion that we're working against is that when I have to do for others and I get nothing in return except that I relate to the system of justice and kindness, and that's the only reason why I do it, so then I feel that is the Eish HaChayil, because I'm running against all the emotions of subservience, and that I really hate doing it, I'm being forced to do it, and I feel jealous of the person that gets the glory. You understand? This person doesn't feel any jealousy against that, because they're only doing that act which is just and right to do, and correct to do. I'm saying it's true when you're in a relationship, sometimes people do for each other. But I'm saying there's sometimes where you don't get anything out of it, where you do just because it's the right thing to be done, and you don't get anything out of it. That's where it shows up, the difference of an Eish HaChayil and a non-Eish HaChayil. That's all. I'm saying in the area of where you get nothing out of it, where you do justice, and let's say you do justice in the community, and nobody knows you're doing it. You just do it privately. There's no good, there's no glory, there's no... If the emotion is that I feel great and I feel special, and I'm doing it for feeling great, then that's not the Eish HaChayil. No, that's not the Eish HaChayil. Yeah, I understand, but that is not the Eish HaChayil. If the emotion is that I'm in line with reality, that I'm doing that which is just and that which is correct, then you're right. That is a good emotion. But if you tell me that I get it because of some ego satisfaction, that I'm doing the right thing, which could be an ego satisfaction, then that is not the Eish HaChayil. The question that is being asked is, this idea is for the man just as well as the woman, it's for every human being, that the highest level of Mishlei is an Eish HaChayil. The question is, so why did they put it on the woman? The answer is that he uses a small system, namely the family, as an example of what a person should be. Her job is very obvious. The woman's job is very obvious to do for the family. But when I go out into the world, the man, you don't usually see that his job is just to help others. In other words, when a king, a righteous king, when he leads the government, there could be two reasons. I'm a king and I want the glory and I want to do it because I'll be remembered or they'll put me on a dollar bill. So he becomes king for that reason. But you can become a king and say, I'm only becoming king because I feel it's my obligation to help the society and benefit the society, I'd rather not be a king. I'd rather be home and learning Torah and not bothering with being the king. But if I recognize that in my situation, that's my responsibility, so then I do it. You see? It's the same type of thing. It's maybe, and you don't even enjoy the glory of being a king. You might enjoy that you're living in line with the ideas of Torah. That is the emotion that you could feel. They say the Rambam, in his later years, he was totally involved with justice. He wrote a letter and he said the only time he has to learn is on Shabbos. The rest of the week he was involved with helping all of Israel. But in political manners and as a doctor, they could afford a doctor, so he would become a doctor for them. In different ways he was just and did for the community. But however, there was no glory, or he definitely didn't do it for any glory. He did it because he recognized that's his job based on the ideas of Mishlei. You see, that's his job. So the thing is, that is the result, the end result of the life of Mishlei. But the reason why they use a woman of valor is because there you see that the woman's job in most societies was just for the family. So it's easy to describe a metaphor, using it as a metaphor of a person that does a life of justice and only thinks of what is necessary for other people because that is the right thing to do, not because of any glory or compliments that they're going to get. It's not defining, you're right, Devorah is right, we're not defining the role of a woman. We're defining the society at that time, that's the way it was most of the time, and just using it as a metaphor, to show your responsibility insofar as a society is, your relationship to justice and kindness in society. In other words, you could call a man an Esh Chayil. It's a metaphor for a lifestyle that's the result of the lifestyle of Mishlei or Proverbs. So, the term Esh Chayil, a woman of valor, applies not just to a woman, but it applies to a certain type of lifestyle. And it applies to man, woman, Jew, or non-Jew. Anybody could reach a level of an Esh Chayil. So now it comes out that the verse means that the woman of valor is a crown to a husband, means that she glorifies and benefits society. Person that lives this type of life, whether it's society or other people, they're kind to another person and they'll help another person become successful and look great or whatever is necessary to help a person for him to be successful. There's nothing, it just, even if there's no benefit to the person themselves, but they only do it for other people. You see? That's the first part. And if you are a person that relates to others and you don't help them, or you do things that are harmful, so that destroys people. You know what I mean? It puts people down and destroys people, and especially where people, their emotions are dependent on how people think of them and things like that, you could destroy a person by your actions. So it's, in general, the idea of, in society in general, is not only the family, but it's the family is only used as a metaphor. In other words, rottenness in the bones is destructive from the inner point, where you don't help people. Usually, it's the opposite. What happens is that you're not nice, and or you say things that are not nice, and or you do actions which are harmful to others. You see, so it totally destroys other people. You see, it embarrasses them, and you bring them down. But on the other hand, if you help others just for their own sake, not that you get any benefit out of it, but you just help them for them to be successful in life, they need something and they're dependent on you for a certain thing and then you help them, So then that's it. So then that you glorify other people or people in society. You glorify them. Even though the only reason why you're doing it is because you see the truth that this is the only way to live the life. Now, our question that we're dealing with is that many times when you're in class and you're listening to somebody, so the mind wanders, okay? And we suggested some practical things and works for some students, like, for instance, taking notes. Some people say when they take notes that, on the contrary, that takes away their mind from thinking. Some people it works. So there were different suggestions of how to deal with the mind wandering, but we don't have any clear-cut, practical, immediate solution. So we're going for the long-term solution, okay? And we'd like to explain, theoretically, what is happening here, okay? There are two parts to the human being. One we call the animalistic part of the human, one we call the conscience. The animalistic part has all the desires, all the things I want to do, okay? The conscience has three components: fear, shame, and guilt. The fear, shame, and guilt stops me and says, it is wrong to do what you're doing, period. It doesn't need an explanation. It just tells you, you are wrong, and the pain of the fear, shame, and guilt stops you. Okay? Now, so therefore, the authority is the teacher or parent or any authority becomes a representative of that part of you which we call the conscience. Because they are forcing you to do something which you would rather not do. In other words, the question is, would you rather be out playing basketball or in here studying? Okay, in the best class, okay, in the class that you're enthusiastic about, still in awe, when it comes down to it, where would you rather be, playing basketball or in class? The answer is basketball. Now, you're forced to stay here because the society says, your parents say, your teacher says, and your grade. You must get a grade because the parents say, the society says, and punishment comes from the teacher. He is the authority, and he represents something that takes away from what we will call the me. The me wants to play basketball. The me wants to play tiddlywinks. The me doesn't want to be here. Okay? But I am forced to be here because the conscience gives the authority, the power for you to stay. Forces you. In other words, the conscience gives you the ability to be trained, but the training comes about by you are controlled by the authority. Okay? As we see in the classroom. It's an obvious example. The mind wandering is, so therefore when your mind wanders, it's just an escape, it's just the me saying that I don't want what's here, and the me moves to something, wanders to my desires, to my needs. Could be my needs consciously, could be my needs unconsciously, but my mind wanders, it escapes from this situation of the authority to a place that is me, that we call the me, because it's what I desire, not what the authority and not what the conscience stops me from doing. Okay? This conflict most people have throughout their lives. The conflict between what the society says, what authority says, and then there's the me that relates to that authority. And the way your personality comes out, how you relate, that's individualistic, on each person how he relates to that authority. Our question, which we're dealing with, is there a way out of this conflict? And what's the way out of the conflict? We'll give an example. The example is like this. Let's say, for instance, somebody tells you smoking is wrong. It's harmful. Then somebody else says, look, it's really not that bad. Okay? It gives you an argument why you should smoke. Okay? Now you have two authorities. Okay? So the question is, which one are you going to listen to? So depending on your personality, one will listen to one will listen to the other. Sometimes there's a so that's one. Or sometimes you desire to smoke. It's not two authorities, but you desire to smoke, and the authority is telling you not to smoke. But either way, you're in conflict. Either way, you're in conflict, either between two authorities or between an authority and yourself. You're in conflict, right? Let's say you would say like this. I am not going to listen to my desire, and I'm not going to listen to any of the authorities, what they say, but the only thing is I'm going to make a decision what my mind tells me that is right. Okay? And the mind tells me the way to go. The mind makes the decision. Now, when my mind makes the decision, not according to my feelings, and not according to the authority, what part of me psychologically is making the decision then? The answer is, it's the me. My mind is, in other words, I'm not listening to any authority. I'm only listening to my mind, which is the me. So the way out of the conflict is by making a decision based on the me. And that's a good point. In other words, let's take jealousy, okay? Jealousy is a conflict, right? Now, the thing is that if you analyze it and you see the destruction, both the consequences in your actions and the conflict in your emotions, you see the harm of jealousy, so your mind tells you that jealousy is not a good thing. So therefore, since jealousy is not a good thing, so then you say that it's the me that is saying it's not good, because my mind sees it clearly. In other words, the question is jealousy a conflict with the conscience or not the conscience? Let's not get involved in the details of a particular conflict. How conflicts work, I'm saying that the way out of conflict in general, we started off with one particular problem, but I'm saying the way out of conflict in general is to attach to the mind, and the mind becomes part of the animalistic part of you. It's because it's the me. My desire is to see the truth, and my desire is to live by the mind. You see? Now, since it is the me, so then I'm out of the conflict. So anything that is harmful to me, even if it's my own emotions that is harmful to me, so then I will get out of that. But you have to see it yourself. You can't accept it based on an authority. You accept it based on an authority, so then you're back in the conflict again. You accept my arguments because I said it, then that's not going to help you. You must accept the argument because your mind sees it. Therefore, I go over it and answer all the questions until the mind sees it. An authority to a thinker is only somebody that opens up their mind to new aspects so that they could investigate it better. But not that the authority makes the decision for them. They make their own decisions. Now, the thing is that you have to realize that to become where the thinking part of you is the me, makes the decision, that's a change in the personality. It's a total change in personality. Yeah. And that will affect your total personality. It's not just that one area. It'll affect the way you look at life, the way you operate in life. Your total being changes. Okay? Is that correct? You'll become a different you at that point. Right. The question is, what gets you from where your life is made by authority to the point where you change your life? What's the process of getting there from step A to step Z? You understand? Step A is where you come to class and the authority shows you that you should. The Torah tells you that you should become a thinker. So you decide to become a thinker because Torah tells you, and your religion tells you, so you decide to become a thinker. Right? Now, what is the process from there till you change into a person that is a thinker? That you make decisions because of your own mind. The thing is, the only thing that can maintain, we always say that you must have a lo lishma. Lo lishma is an incorrect motive, okay, that drives you, okay? In other words, let's say, for instance, I want to be a thinker. But thinking is a very painful thing. I don't want to be in class. I'd rather be playing tiddlywinks, okay, instead of being in class. Is that correct? Now, what's going to force me to stay in class and continue learning? Let's say you have the freedom to walk out. What's going to make me continue? It's going to be a lo lishma, something, an incorrect motive, but not the true motive. Not because the true motive is where I see the truth of the ideas, that ideas are real, and that is the best possible life, and I must live that type of life. A false motive could be religion. A false motive could be an incorrect motive could be grades. Okay, you want your parents to like you. Parents promise you they'll give you a car if you get good grades. So there's all these things that are motivating you, okay? But those are all incorrect decisions. The only thing that change comes about only when you're correctly in the where you see the correct value of ideas. It's not for any other reason, but you recognize the true value of ideas, right? Now the thing is, all these motives that are motivating you is an authority, is the conscience. So the conscience will drive you to continue working. Without the conscience, you couldn't work. You wouldn't be able to operate. So you need the conscience to keep motivating you until you relate to the learning, not through the conscience, but through the me. The very me. So it changes position. The learning changes from what component of the you that is motivating you to learn. So you are guided by an authority or by the conscience that is driving you. But the very learning itself, at a certain point, the mind will recognize the value and be drawn to the very ideas of the life of learning, you see, where it'll become part of the animalistic part of you, a part of the me part of you, that you will desire to learn, and then that is a change in your total personality. In other words, the reason why you're learning is because of your conscience. Okay? The authority says so. So you allow the conscience to drive you on. Keeps motivating you. Yeah, but you have no choice. You must go that route. Don't fight it. Okay? Don't fight it. Because that's natural. The only thing that will get you out of the conscience is where you, through your learning, you see the truth and reality of ideas. And once the mind sees it so clearly, there's a certain point of development where it becomes a desire to learn and to be attached to these ideas, because you see the because of the truth of the ideas, and at that point there's a change in your total personality from the conscience to the me. It's not a matter of using the conscience. It's a matter of the conscience forces you to study, and the study itself becomes so real to you, and the reality of it and the benefits of it and everything that you see in it draws you to truth, and then there is a change in your total personality. In other words, you can't force yourself to become a thinker. It's just a natural result of just learning. So you can't fight the lo lishma, or the incorrect motive. You just live with it, and then it is a natural change by your relationship to learning. But you can only get it through learning. In other words, one of the studies that will help you make the change is the study of conflict itself. Well, let's say we have a discussion. What is jealousy? We talk about jealousy, right? Now, that's going to impress you when you see, when your mind tells you that, yeah, jealousy is really bad. It's really foolish to be jealous. It's not going to stop you from being jealous, but the mind sees it. Then you go into vengeance, and you see vengeance is stupid. Then you see where you're drawn to extremes in the physical pleasures. You see, that's stupid, and that's harmful. And slowly but surely, as you go through everything step by step in the physical world, as we're doing now, so you start seeing the foolishness of that type of life. So the mind takes over, and it is a change from the conscience to the me, or the animalistic part of you. Okay? Though the life of learning is painful when you start out because you must use the conscience. And since you're using the conscience, you're going to be in conflict, and there'll be terrible conflicts in it, but it is well worth it to put your energy into it, because the results will be that you'll pull out of the conflict. In other words, let me explain it this way, okay? For you to make a living in our modern society, you have to go 8 years to elementary school, you have to go to 4 years high school, and a minimum of 4 years college. Let's just stop there. That's 16 years of torture that you're forced to do homework, take tests, and all the conflicts that you have that go with school and with your good teachers and all your bad teachers that make you suffer. Okay? And so therefore, you work 16 years to satisfy one aspect of your life, to make a living. And it's a very important part of your life. You have to make a living. I'm saying, shouldn't you be able to suffer a certain amount of suffering to work towards removing all your conflicts? That when you work, you will not feel conflict, but you'll do it because reality dictates, not because authority dictates. Isn't it worth it to spend a little more effort to satisfy, to remove conflicts? You spend 16 years of torment to satisfy one, and it's very important. I'm not denying the importance of that aspect, but it's only one aspect. Most people are not happy. They make a living, but they can't tell me they're happy. I'm showing you how to be happy. Isn't it worth a certain amount of conflict and troubles and work to be able to become happy? The question that we're dealing with is, why do some teachers get respect and some teachers don't? So we went through the room to get different qualities. So we went through the room and we asked different qualities of what people like about a teacher or don't like. Okay. These were the answers that came up from the class. Care about their job. The teacher cares about his job. He's not dumber than the student. The student doesn't feel smarter. He's not equal to the student. He's a certain amount above the student, but yet you sense that he cares about the student. Okay? If he has a unique way of teaching,
that also draws him, and he doesn't look down on the student. In other words, he's above the student, but he doesn't look down on the student. And then there was one more consistency, but we'll deal with consistency later. We'll take these and then deal with the consistency. I would like to use two terms and define them. One is authority and one is a father figure. Like you look up to him with a certain amount of respect, certain feeling akin, not exactly, but akin to a father. Okay? Authority is where I look up to a person with authority and maybe even respect them, but however, it's not that feeling. It's not a father figure. Okay? Like, for instance, people look up to rock stars. You understand? They look up to them. But I think there's a different feeling. Now, the reason for the different feeling is not because of the emotions, but because of reality. The rock star, you realize that you cannot get close to him, or he's far above you, so there is no relationship. Even though if you daydream about him, you would daydream about him equal to a father figure. Okay? But it's the reality that keeps it separate. Okay, so you see that in the emotions, there is a desire for a father figure. So you see in the daydreams, they daydream exactly like the father figure. They probably demand the same qualities of the father figure. Okay? Okay, so we have, when it comes to something like a rock star or an athlete, right? So therefore there seems to be two ways of relating. Some daydream that they could compete with them and beat them. Some people look at them as a father figure. Okay, so there's two ways of looking at it. Okay, now, so therefore you see one thing, that the emotion, when they're relating to an authority, right, or to this father figure, they're looking for one of two things. Either they're looking for something akin, that would be akin to a father figure, that's comparable to a father figure, or that they're equal to them, or they're a competition with them. Okay? So therefore, that's the reason why you gave all these examples here that you mentioned, which would be akin to what you would expect from a parent. Child doesn't like when a parent tries to be equal to them. They feel insecure. There's a certain insecurity if the father is equal to them, or you feel better than the parent. There's a certain insecurity because your security is dependent on them. The question is that some people said that with a parent, sometimes they feel they could outdo the parent. So yes, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that the father figure, there are two relationships to the father figure, or to the parent for that matter. It's one is security. There's a feeling that you need them for security, or you're in competition with them and you want to beat them. You see? Insofar as the descriptions that we got yesterday, everybody described a father figure, that they expect of the teacher to give them the security of being above them, but yet being warm and sincere and really wanting to do this so they care about them, right? And they have something new, something special about their parent, that's something different than anybody else. My parent is special. You see what I mean? So the father figure, or the parent figure, you see, is something special. That's what a child looks for in a parent. So they replace the teacher with that, and with all authorities. And now sometimes you could feel a competition with the teacher. You want to outdo the teacher. That's because within the relationship with the parent, or the parent figure, you see, there is that double, two-edged relationship. There's a certain dependency that you feel secure when you have them. Simultaneously, you want to outdo them. Now, they demand consistency. The student demands
of the teacher certain consistency. If it's inconsistent, so then they feel insecure. Okay? Again, in the mind of the person, or in this case, in the mind of the student, there are two parent figures. There's two types of two types of authorities. There's the good authority and the bad authority. And you know how to operate in each case. You react to the nice authority in one way, and you act to the bad authority in another way. When it's inconsistent, it means that in one way he's like the bad authority, and in one way he's like the good authority, and it's a hard thing to deal with the both. You see? In other words, if a teacher is a strict authoritarian, you understand? And even if he doesn't care about you, you might look at him as a bad teacher. You might not like him, but you know what to expect, and you deal with him as you would deal with a bad authority, an evil authority, a harmful authority. How you would learn how to protect yourself against a harmful authority. You see? But however, insofar as father figure, again, you would know how to react. But the inconsistency causes a conflict in how to relate to this person. I don't know whether to relate to him as the one minute he's the good father figure, one minute he's the evil father figure. So the question is how to relate to him. Therefore, you hate such a person because he brings out this conflict within you. The question that we're dealing with, why is it wrong to cheat? The first possibility is that it's only cheating if you get caught. If you don't get caught, then there's nothing wrong with it. I'd like to ask you a question, okay? The question is, if you hold that it's only getting caught, let's say you would cheat in a situation where you would harm somebody else, or if you would harm yourself, okay, would then cheating be worth it? The example that has been given is that, let's say somebody's studying to be a doctor and he cheats on all his tests. So then he comes out with a degree as a doctor, but he doesn't know anything about his profession. He's going to harm others, and soon he'll be caught. And so therefore, he's harming others and himself. Okay? So the question is, would you hold that cheating is okay in that situation? Do you hold that cheating is not good in that situation? Okay? Now, the question is, let's say you're in a race and you take a shortcut. Now, the thing is, the reason why you're racing is a certain competition. There's certain benefits, either that I'm successful and I feel about myself a certain way, or there's money prizes that could be gotten. So therefore, that's being taken away from them. The whole purpose of the race is being taken away from them. So the question is what is the case where you would say that cheating is okay? The question is that we're looking for different cases about cheating. The question is, why are we getting so many particular cases about cheating? Okay? The answer is that, and you also noticed in the Gemara gives very strange cases, you see? Now the thing is, we have a certain theory here that's going operating here in cheating. Cheating is wrong only if it's harmful to you or somebody else. That's the theory that we have, why cheating is wrong, okay? Now, what you're showing me cases that where cheating is, where I could cheat without harming anybody, okay? And therefore, the question is, in that case, would it be okay to cheat? So it's a test on the theory. You're bringing cases to test out the theory. And even though the case might be a weird case and it might never happen, but the fact is it's enough to affect the theory, whether the theory works or not. Okay? So what Max is asking, Max is saying, is let's say, for instance, there's an unbelievable genius, a mathematician, but he can't write a paper. Okay? Let's say, for instance, a person has golden hands insofar as surgery, but he can't stay up 18 hours a day and operate. He needs his 8 hours sleep, or he can't operate. In our society, he would not be accepted, even though they would be better in the field than somebody else. Okay? Or, for instance, there's some people even in class where they have a... where they know the work, but they get tense in the test. They can't take a test. In our society, he might be better than somebody else, but our society would say he he's no good. And so the question in that case, would it be worth it to cheat? On the contrary, it's a benefit for these type of people to cheat. It would come out a benefit. And when the society is causing the harm, and his cheating is making up for the harm that the society made. Now somebody asked, would you say, so therefore you would be allowed to cheat in that situation? I cannot answer the question, because when you're involved in a certain area, you must investigate every single angle and even accept the possibility that the wrong thing is correct or the correct thing is wrong, to make sure that the mind investigates every single step and every single angle. But we can't draw a conclusion until we finish the discussion completely. But in the midst of the discussion, we must be open-minded to every possibility. At this point in the investigation, based on the theory that we have, we would say in that situation it would be permissible to cheat. Okay? We have, till now, is that what we're saying is the theory is if it harms somebody else or harms me, then I should not cheat. Okay? We have a case where you're correcting something that is wrong. Okay? That's one case. There's another case that questions the theory, okay? Let's say, for instance, I want to be a doctor, okay? But to get through high school and sometimes college, I have to take certain courses, like let's say I have to take poetry, okay? And I definitely will not benefit me in my profession, okay? And what I want to do at the time, if I cheat during the poetry, what I want to do during the time, so I'm not going to take over anybody's job in poetry, because I'm not even going in there, I want to learn Torah during that time. I'll have extra time to learn Torah, so I wouldn't have to study the poetry. I know I could do it in such a way where I will not get caught, I'm not harming anybody else, and I'm benefiting that I'm learning Torah. So the question is, in that situation, am I allowed to cheat? In other words, there's a benefit that I'm learning Torah, I'm developing and getting closer to God, and simultaneously, I'm not harming anybody and I'm not harming myself, because I'm going to be a doctor, and so I have nothing to do with poetry, so all it is only to make sure that I need it to become a doctor. We'll define the difference between the first question and the second question. Is the first question is Max's question, and the second question is Max's question. Okay? And just adding to Max's point, it doesn't only have to be Torah. Let's say during this time that I cheated on the poetry, I'm studying more time, putting more time into medicine, so I'll become a better doctor. So that would be the benefit. Yeah, so it could be a benefit that way too. So that way, we're saying, according to our theory, doesn't harm anybody and there is a benefit, then you should be able to cheat. Okay? So we have two different cases where we should be able to cheat. Right. Max's question, which was the first question, is where this society has a system that will remove, that is a harm, and it's harmful to the citizens, by the rule, in other words, in the case that we're talking about, that they make demands on a grade in such a way where somebody might be a greater mathematician or a greater doctor, but he can't take a test or he can't write a paper. You understand? So therefore, because of these things, because of these demands which he doesn't need for his profession, they take him away from his profession and he might be the better person. So one, Max's question is based on a weakness in society. The second question is based on my particular situation, what's more beneficial to me, as long as it's not harmful to anybody else. In Max's question, it's not that the society is evil, they have rules. But some of the rules are harmful. They made stupid rules, and it comes out harmful to the individual. So maybe in that situation, it would be correct to cheat. The question is, what about morals and ethics? Morally, we know that it's wrong to cheat. And so therefore, morally, we should not cheat. Okay? The answer is, in Judaism, our morals and ethics is based on where I could prove that it is harmful or beneficial. It's not because the society says it is wrong or the society says it's good. That is the book of, that's really Musar. Anyway, my interpretation of Musar. Musar is where when you study Torah and you want to investigate, first you accept Torah because of authority, that God gave us the Torah. But then you have the right to investigate the benefit of the Torah. What are the benefits of Torah? You see? So therefore I have the right to investigate. If I accept God and the Torah and I obey God, then there's a secondary thing. I have the right to investigate Torah to find out what is the benefit or harm in what they, in other words, if they prohibit, what's the harm? If they command you to do, what's the benefit? I have the right to do that. Okay? So therefore, we are asking, what is the benefit or harm of cheating? We are investigating that very question, and it'll only become moral or ethical, or immoral or unethical, only after the investigation, and it fits in with Torah. Okay? In other words, if it doesn't fit in with Torah, once we have proven that God gave the Torah on Mount Sinai, so then what the Torah says is a fact to me. So if I find my philosophy contradicts Torah, it's like contradicting a fact. So then I have to further investigate to straighten out that fact. That's the only difference between the philosopher and the Jew, is the Jew has another fact that the regular philosopher doesn't have, which is an unbelievable advantage. Because I could test out, not only in the physical world, my ideas, but also in Torah. I have to test them out in both, because they're both facts to me. The question is what about a person where he gets a scholarship to college, and this is the thing that is done, that he gets a scholarship to college based on his athletic abilities. Okay? Now, wouldn't that be cheating? The answer is that we might come to the conclusion after the investigation that our society has rules that is against, that is really cheating. And it's really against the ideas of morals and ethics, because it really doesn't make sense and it became part of their system. We might come to that conclusion. But that, whether that conclusion is correct or not, could only be worked out only after the total investigation. But from where we are standing now, from what we're saying, I would say it's definitely cheating. I would say they built in the system a means of cheating, because this guy is going to get a college degree when really he doesn't deserve a college degree, and because he's only a sports person, and therefore he shouldn't be able to get in college based on that. And it's cheating because it's taking away his space from somebody that really deserves, because of his scholastics, he should get into college. So at this point, I would say that it definitely is cheating. Max is also helping his argument by giving a very beautiful example of where the society is wrong, and therefore maybe cheating should cheat to right the wrong of society. And that is the scholarship that a person gets for his sportsmanship. He gets sportsmanship to college, so he says they're advocating sportsmanship, or in other words, they're advocating entertainment over the world of ideas. In other words, inherent in there, they're saying that entertainment, and from the college point of view, they make money on these things, and money, entertainment, and money is more important than education. So therefore, it might be necessary to cheat so that you could get an education to overcome a weakness of society, and therefore you have the right to do it. It is possible. At this point, we don't know. Insofar as harm and benefit, at this point, I would say yes, cheating would be allowed in this situation at this point. But we have to finish the investigation. The question is affirmative action, where we give certain people, because of race, an advantage in the scholarship, even though they might not be the best. There might be others that is better. There might be others that are better, and we're giving people an advantage. Okay? It could be an affirmative action. I'm not 100% sure because of this. Affirmative action came about to correct an injustice in society. In society, there were certain people, simply because of bigotry, was not given the same chances as other races. One race was put down because of their race, and the others, and their equality was taken away from them. And affirmative action was an attempt to straighten it out. Whether it's just and whether it's the correct way of straightening it out or not, that's a separate question. But affirmative action is definitely not equal to sports. Sports is definitely a different value system, while affirmative action was an attempt to straighten it out. Whether you agree with affirmative action or not is dependent on when you straightened out an injustice, did you cause an injustice in another side, or no, this is the correct way of doing it. That's the difference of if you agree or disagree with affirmative action. But affirmative action, the purpose of affirmative action, was a good thing. They were trying to straighten out an evil in the society. That's not sports giving a sportsman an advantage over intellectualism. That's taking away from the whole benefit and showing the value of being an intellectual. That's an inherent harm to the society. In affirmative, the question is that here also we're giving an unfair advantage to the race, like in this case the African American. So the thing is that we're taking away from intellectualism. Okay, you have to understand there's two types of intellectualism. We hold justice is based on ideas. The ideas of justice is ideas, and then there's ideas in math, science, medicine. You see, now the question is, Which intellectualism takes priority? Definitely, according to Torah, and even in the world, the idea of justice, which is based on chachma, wisdom, definitely takes precedence over the ideas of math and science. And so, therefore, on the contrary, it's advocating a greater intellectualism and a greater truth than the others. In other words, I'm not saying whether affirmative action is right or wrong, but I'm just changing where the argument of affirmative action is. It's whether to straighten out an injustice, were we doing a greater injustice, or that it's correct that this is the way to straighten out that injustice. I'm not saying whether affirmative action is right or wrong. I'm just showing you where the argument is. I was saying there are three types of cheating. There's one, the individual who cheats on a test. Two, where the society cheats, like on a scholarship, on an athletic scholarship. And then there is affirmative action, which could be that the motive was right, but the method in which they answered it, they went too far, so that became cheating. That's a possibility, if that is the correct answer. Yes?
I would like to clarify the difference between the science and study of justice and the science of math and science. You see, the search for truth is never in the what you do, but in the basic premises. Once you have a certain, let's say, I have a false basic premise, then I could build up based on that false basic premise very logical system. But the truth of that system is not within the system, but in the basic premise of the system. Okay? That is the basis of all life. And that is where the ultimate truth is going to lie, in the basic premises. Justice is the basic premise of life. That you must know what is justice. You must go through all the ideas of justice and prove what justice is. Math and science, how you should use math and science, how much you should invest in math and science, is going to depend on your basic premises. So therefore, justice is a higher level of reality than the math and science, because justice deals with the basic premises of all life, of how to live life. So therefore, it becomes a priority to all other sciences. In other words, we're not against entertainment, but if entertainment comes the basis of life, that is harmful. The basis of life should be the mind and the development of the mind, how you look at life, but you need a break, so you go for entertainment. But however, if the society is advocating entertainment as the basic premise, and that it's more important than the intellectual world, that is a destructive part of society. I would like to introduce another theory in the world of cheating. Okay. And that is this. Jacob, when he raised Joseph, he made an error. He had a certain emotion of attachment to Joseph, and he made an error in raising him. And he made a mistake, and he bought him a coat which represents that he made him greater and brought out Joseph or Yosef Sego. Okay? That he became haughty. Now you have to understand, I mean, it wasn't an open blunder like I'm saying it now. I mean, it was a mistake in judgment. We're not going to get into details of what exactly, in his case, what the mistake is, but I'm just showing you that the Torah definitely holds that it was a mistake in judgment. Okay, that's all we need to know. Now, as a result of that judgment, God had Yosef sold down to Egypt, and Yaakov thought that he was dead. Now, God could have straightened out Yaakov and told him that Yosef is not dead. God did not tell him. God did not give him that prophecy. In other words, God wanted him to be in that state. Now, because of his attachment to Yosef, he mourned for Yosef. His attachment was so strong that he mourned for Yosef for 22 years.
which shows that it was a powerful, powerful emotion, and that emotion was affecting his thinking process. Okay? Now, prophecy, person cannot get prophecy unless he is in a happy mood. He can't be sad. And because of that, Yaakov did not get prophecy for 22 years, meaning his development was not on the level which it could be if he actually got prophecy. Since he didn't get prophecy, so his development was stunted to a certain extent. And yet you see that God allowed that stunt, that he should lose out on that development, so that he should be depressed, and once he's depressed, he'd realize that there is a powerful emotion, and so he'll be able to deal with that emotion and try to straighten it out, and so he had to spend 22 years to straighten it out before God again spoke to him and gave him prophecy. This interpretation is basically from Chazal and also from Rabbi Chait, his view of Chazal. Okay? But from this we see that perfection, in other words, the Torah wants a certain perfection of the person. You have to be careful here. There's a perfection that the ego demands, or sometimes society demands, or some authorities like a parent or a teacher demand, which is beyond reality. That type of, or sometimes we demand of ourselves a perfection that is beyond reality. That type of perfection is a harmful type of perfection. But there is a perfection insofar as that which is possible for a human being. Okay? And that perfection means that practically the emotions never affect my decision-making process. And the Torah holds that you should develop that and remove any emotion that affects a decision-making. In other words, you don't have to deal with the emotions or undo emotions unless you see an emotion affects the way you make decisions. And from our case, we see that God holds that that's more important than the knowledge of God. Because Yaakov, what would he be working on about ideas of God? Ideas of justice, ideas of getting closer to God. And because he lost that level of prophecy, he could not get that knowledge. And God held that it's more important that he should remove the emotion that affects his thinking process. That becomes more important than the level of the logical mind developing, getting closer to God. Okay? So therefore, a person must not only see reality and truth in his mind, but there can't be anything in his emotions that affect that truth and that reality. Okay? Anything that's going to affect that reality must be removed. Okay? That is what the Torah holds. And you see, that's a good thing from all our discussions in Mishlei and the consequences of the emotions. You see also it's practical that a person should reach this level. Okay? So now we have to view cheating from this view of Torah. We're going to go over this idea again to clarify it, but we're going to leave out the proof from Yaakov. Okay? Right. There is, in other words, when you think through a problem, the mind is working to decide what is the best way of working out a problem. I'll give you a simple example. You have a test the next day, and there is a TV movie on that you've been waiting for years to catch on TV, and you can't copy it because your the VCR is broken, and you are going to watch it or take the test, right? At that moment, you can't even think of the possibility Like the whole possibility of taking a test is totally ignored. It's totally not even in your mind. You don't think about it. You forget about it. And at that moment, you go for the movie. You see? So the emotion did not allow you to make a decision correctly in that situation. There was a powerful emotion affecting your decision-making process. Now, let's say, for instance, I know I have a problem with a certain emotion, this emotion that we have, that we just gave the example. And now I could have time to study Torah or to deal with that emotion. But I can't do both. One of them is going to be lost. I could spend my time, and I spend years learning Torah and developing Torah, but I'm not going to spend my time on developing this. Or I could spend a certain amount of time on developing this, but I'll lose that on my Torah. The question is, which one is more important? All we showed from Yaakov was that God want the priority should be in dealing with the emotion that affect the way you make decisions. In most cases, people could do both. They could spend a certain amount of hours learning and a certain amount of time. You know, you can't, this is a difficult thing, you have a certain amount of time dealing with your emotion. Most people could do both. But let's say you couldn't do both, you could only do one at a time. Okay? The Torah would tell you that the priority is dealing with the emotion that affects your thinking process. That would come first. Okay? That becomes more important than the world of getting more ideas in Torah. That's my understanding of the story of Yaakov. Now, if we take this in mind and go back to the idea, again, this is, I'm evaluating, I'm not going away from the old theory of harm and benefit, but I'm taking a particular harm and a particular benefit, which is very universal, but however, it's still subdivided under harm and benefit, and we want to see how this will work out in the different cases that we have been dealing with. So we'd like to go through all the areas. The first area, there was a question before that was asked like this. Let's say, for instance, a person wants to be a doctor, but he wants to cheat on poetry so he could study more medicine, or because he wants to learn Torah. Right? That was one. Let's say, for instance, we have a question prior to that. Let's say, for instance, a person is not harming anybody, and he is cheating on poetry, the same case on poetry, only because he wants to go home and relax. Okay? There in that case, we would say that that's definitely wrong, because he's advocating an emotion that would harm him. That is really a harm. So that definitely would not be acceptable. Okay? That would definitely not be acceptable. Let's say it's a benefit for you, like the case of the doctor, but it doesn't harm anybody else. But there's a benefit that you'll have more time to study. Either you'll study Torah, or you'll study more medicine, so you'll be a better doctor, which is a benefit to society. Okay? Over there also, it is a harm to the person's personality. Why? Because when the teacher is teaching and society expects has a certain expectation of you. They have a certain expectation. That expectation is that you're going to get the knowledge that the teacher has to offer, and the grade just represents that how much knowledge you got, so people can know what knowledge you got. Okay? That's society has the right to expect that, and in any given society, they have the right to expect that idea in the group, that expectation. therefore cheating in that type of situation is a harm to the soul, because that's a reality based on ideas of justice in operating within a society. There's certain expectations of the individual, and therefore where there are expectations of the individual, then you cannot cheat where the society demands a certain proper way of acting, which the society has the right and the justice to demand that of you. And when you cheat on that, you are cheating from reality, and therefore you are harming your very personality and affecting and strengthening the emotional part of you that will make your decision-making component of the human being defective. And what about where there is the society is unjust and you are cheating to straighten out the injustice? Now the question is, what about where the society has a defect and there's something unjust? Do you have the right to cheat to compensate for that situation? Okay? It could be that we have a proof for that. Because we find that Yaakov and Rivka, his mother, worked out a plan to deceive Yitzchak, where he was going to make an error, he's going to harm society. If he gave a blessing to Esav, that would have definitely harmed society. And to compensate for that mistake, Rivka and Yaakov worked out a plan. It was really Rivka's plan to work out to deceive Yitzchak, to compensate for that mistake. So you see that you have the right to cheat in a situation where you're to compensate, according to this theory, to compensate for society. I would just like to tell you one point practically. You have to check out in halacha what the law is about cheating, which would be sometimes, it could be under the category of lying, or it could be under the category of Ganevas Das, where Ganevas Das is where I compliment you where I really don't feel it. I'm telling you something only to win you over, but it's not the truth. I'm deceiving you. That is also prohibited, and we could see why it's prohibited, because that would train you to deceive people, which is against reality, and it would harm your personality. So the thing is that, but we see that by Yaakov, we see practically that you can't do it in a certain situation. If the situation that we gave is exactly equal, and how the halacha is, that has to be checked out by the halacha. I'm not sure what the halacha is. But based on our discussion, definitely such a situation, you would have the right to compensate for such a situation. At this point, the discussion, unless there are any questions. Going over the idea of poetry, where I'm going to cheat on poetry so that I could learn Torah or become a better doctor. Okay? There is a certain system of justice. In other words, we have an educational program that we feel that the human being needs in our society. And it's not unjust. It's not something that's unjust. It's an expectation that the society has of you. As a citizen of this government, since even another government might not have that expectation for you, and it would be not a weakness, but it's not an injustice. Okay? That expectation the government has the right to demand of you. And if you go against it, you see, that is, cheating is going against the government. Going against a system that they have a right to expect of their citizens certain things, certain ideas. Whether it's not harmful to anybody, it's just that they feel that when you graduate, you should be an all-around person, and knowledge in all different areas, even in poetry. Okay? So they have the right to demand that of you. Okay? And therefore, if you cheat, so therefore, you are harming yourself because you have accepted to live under this government, and you must live by the rules of the government as long as it's not unjust. On the other hand, we have the right, just like the government has certain expectations of us, we have certain expectations of the government that they should make sure they have a just system and they carry out that system justly in a correct manner. We have expectations of the government. And it is possible, based on the story of Yaakov, it is possible that if they do not carry out their